Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hyperlinks by Fiona Quinn. Narrated by Jesse Malinsky. London Bridge is. London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. London Bridge is falling down, my fair lady. Build it up with iron and steel, iron and steel, iron and steel. Build it up with iron and steel, my fair lady. Iron and steel will bend and bow, bend and bow, bend and bow. Iron and steel will bend and bow, my fair lady. Build it up with silver and gold, silver and gold, silver and gold. Build it up with silver and gold, my fair lady. Chapter 1. It was such a relief when my phone's buzz suddenly yanked me awake. Mentally thrashing through an endless dream, I was too exhausted to stay asleep. I had gone to bed last night braced for torment, whether it showed up as warm, loving pictures or angst-filled ones. Either would make my heart bleed. Today was Mom's birthday. In my life, which was overflowing with heroes, she stood out as the miracle maker. I missed her dearly. All day yesterday, childhood memories had been popping up. My brain had been feeding them to me like bonbons. Closing my eyes, I savored each one. The flavor on my tongue of Mom's extra special raspberry chocolate rum cake. The warmth of her voice as she whispered, "You're my favorite," into my ear. The earnestness in her eyes as she gave me good counsel, or just stared out the window, thinking. I remembered Mom as bright slashes of color on her palette as she brought her imagination into a tangible form on a canvas. Whenever I saw a bouquet of flowers, she was there in the richness of the hues and the delicacy of the petals, easily bruised and crushed. She was still part of me every day. Painfully sometimes. Joyfully sometimes. The emptiness she left was only made more acute this last week as I probed around my memories like a tongue, finding and fiddling with the space from a lost childhood tooth. Only this ache didn't come with the expected tooth fairy reward. Or knowing that another tooth would come in and replace the baby one that had fallen out. Nothing could replace Mom. There were just certain days that were more biting than others. Her birthday was always the hardest for me. My life growing up had been enchanted. My parents had given me the Willy Wonka gold ticket of childhoods. Living a working-class lifestyle, my father seemingly owned a garage and acted as a mechanic. I believed that to be true until last year. That's when I discovered that the garage was a cover story for his actual job, as a CIA officer. Though my family didn't have a lot of material trappings, I never felt want. My parents filled my life with the colorful, the exciting, even the fantastical at times. And they brought into my unschooled education a parade of amazing people to mentor and teach me, despite Mom's being sick for almost all of my life. Mom's imminent death had been part of my everyday. And because I kept expecting her to die and then she didn't, I convinced myself she'd always beat the odds. That she'd be able to stay in her bed where she'd always been, making a nest of pillows for me to join her. I'd cuddle up to listen to her read to me, or I'd draw quietly while she slept. Dad had positioned the parental king-sized bed in such a way that we could watch through the window as airplanes flew low in the sky on the way to one of the DC airports. We'd tell each other imagined stories of the great adventures that the passengers had just lived. Mom's gentle smile and creative way of viewing life. I still needed her. I never really got a chance to mourn her passing. Not properly. Right after her death, my life had spun out of control. I became the focus of a serial killer who started a parade of criminals through my life. They were now in my past. And I was slowly recovering, both physically and emotionally, from the years of terror. In my toolbox of valuable skills, I had my mother's example of sheer, dogged perseverance that had helped me through those terrible times. Mom had heroically clung to life for as long as she could. As my last remaining relative, her big goal was to stay alive until I was a legal adult. She hoped to see my 21st birthday. Valiantly, she made it until I was 19 and a half. Then one day, to my great sorrow and equally to my great relief, she just stopped. Her transition to life beyond was peaceful, where her illness hadn't been. That day, I carried a tray with her preferred breakfast, a pot of orange pico tea, toast with honey, and a banana, into her room. The stillness as I pushed through the door stood like a sentry. It stopped me from entering. Hovering in the hall, I looked through the crack and realized that the room was empty, though Mom was in the bed. She had traveled from this world to the next, joining Dad on the other side. Mom must have known it was close. She went to bed that night with my pink baby blanket and had it clutched to her chest. When I was very little and couldn't sleep, Mom would wrap me in that soft pink blanket and carry me out to the tiny balcony off the living room in the Washington, D.C. apartment where I lived my entire life until it burned to the ground. I loved that apartment. It was the center of my own special universe. Outside, with the white noise of the highway buzz, Mom would cuddle me into her as she soothed me. I would block the smell of the city by burrowing my nose into Mom's dress. The savory scent of garlic and onions, spices, and lemony dish detergent would fill my nostrils. It was bliss. All the strains and upsets of my little life fell away with the steady cadence of the old-fashioned wooden rocker's creaks and thumps. Mom hummed nonsensical notes instead of any recognizable melody. Her cheek rested against my head, so she could turn and plant kisses in my hair when she took a breath in to hum again. When she did sing an infrequent song, it was usually something monotonous and straightforward, like, "Row, row, row your boat." The truth was that Mom's talents were visual, and she had minimal capacity to find a beat or a melody. It embarrassed her because Dad and I both had good voices. Dad had been in a band all through college. He'd had to make a choice at some point to give that up to follow his career with the CIA. Imagine sitting on a dorm room bed and thinking, "Will I be a spy or a rock star?" My dad was a rock star to me, even if he made the choice to let his music become an avocation. Mom liked to listen to us singing together, but I think she felt left out. Before I went to sleep last night, my fiancé, Stryker Reese, had shown me an online video of a teenaged a cappella group singing rock. There was one young teen who tickled my fancy. He held the tempo with his beatboxing, which he took very seriously, as well he should. He had carrot red hair, porcelain skin, and looked completely cherubic as his mouth made the sounds of cymbals crashing. I could just imagine him showing up at the audition, wanting to participate in the group, and being told his voice wasn't up to standard. Undeterred, he found a way to join in. Mom would have loved that. And so, as I lay in bed with Stryker beside me, not wanting to toss and turn and interrupt his sleep, I was thinking again about Mom. In my imagination, I pretended to wrap myself in the pink blanket, sending myself down memory lane onto the balcony. And there I imagined baby me lying in Mom's arms as she monotoned, "Row, row, row your boat." And that was what I had done all night in my dreams. It hadn't been a pink, fluffy blanket, sweet dreams kind of boat ride. It was the nightmare kind. The danger is imminent kind. My mother had stood on the bank with her bare feet in the roiling waters, one hand clinging to a branch, the other cupped around her mouth, screaming at me, "Row faster, Lexi! Faster! You have to get away! Go, go, go!" And because I believed my mom, trusted my mom to always do the best she could to protect me and keep me safe, even in a dangerous and turbulent world, I rowed. Hours of frantic rowing. And now, with a rubbery arm and physical exhaustion, I reached for my phone, buzzing on my nightstand before it woke Stryker. Grateful, even if it was a wrong number, that by waking up, I had made it to shore and could stop. I stroked my thumb across the screen and whispered, "Hello?
In a moment, you will get a call from the FBI. Take the call. Accept the invitation. Out."
The phone went dead. Chapter 2. Stryker came awake beside me.
"Who was that?"
He scrubbed a hand over his eyes and scratched through his short-cropped, rusty blonde hair.
"What time is it?"
"Spider," I whispered, turning the phone to check the readout. "It's almost 5. Go back to sleep." Stryker rolled onto his side and bent his arm to elevate his head. His features were hard to read in the dim indigo of near dawn coming through my bedroom window.
"And?"
I tipped my head. "A call supposed to come in from the FBI. Spider told me to take the meeting."
"All right, Chica."
He shifted the covers off him. I wish he hadn't. Stryker went to bed naked last night. His morning, ready-for-a-tumble body was darned enticing. Broad shoulders, tight abs, those thigh muscles, and... phew. If only I knew when this FBI call would be coming through, I might have taken advantage of waking up before the alarm rang.
"But I'm going to remind you."
Stryker tapped my hip, refocusing me.
"We already have a meeting on the books today at 1100 hours. Spider wouldn't have called like that if it wasn't high priority. This meeting at the CIA is too."
I pulled myself up to sitting, punching a pillow, and laid it against the headboard, leaning back. The ready for a conversation position. "Do you know what's going on at the CIA? A gist? A whiff?"
"This is what I know."
He pushed himself up to sit against the headboard beside me. I would have felt a lot more guilty about his losing sleep if Stryker wasn't the kind of guy who could get by on 4 hours of shut-eye and then head out to compete in a triathlon. Must be nice. That definitely wasn't me. Coffee would help.
"The original meeting was scheduled," Stryker said, "with a room full of people connected with the case. Once Iniqua's command confirmed with the CIA working group that I was bringing you with me, that room full narrowed down to 3.
I shrugged. "So maybe it's not that important, and it would be okay if you take notes and catch me up later?" Amusement twitched at the corners of his lips. So darned cute.
"I'm going to speculate based on tone."
"Okay."
"This is an ongoing mission that needs to be solved. They can't figure it out. They called Iniquis in, hoping for a fresh perspective."
I didn't need to see his face. I could tell by his tone that Stryker found this turn of events entertaining. I drew my brows together. And that amuses you. Why?
Because I don't think they know what they have headed through their doors. Or maybe they do, and that's why they made the changes from a roomful down to the three main players.
More?
I know exactly how this is going to go down. You're going to listen to their information. Then you're going to say something so obvious that they're all going to look like buffoons for not spotting it themselves. The fewer witnesses to the thrumming, the better. If the lore about your solve rate spread to this group, they're trying to limit the reputational damage.
Psh. I got out of bed, picking up my cell phone as I moved.
You think I'm kidding?
He clicked on the side lamp. I turned just in time to catch the full-blown dimple action of his grin. He wasn't playing fair. I needed to be focused and professional for this incoming FBI call, not caught panting and sighing into the phone as I played with Stryker. Stryker laced his fingers behind his head. Uh-huh. He knew exactly what he was doing with that display of his. As my heart thumped a "go get him and have some fun" beat, I turned to my panties drawer and dug around.
Iniqua's command has bets laid amongst themselves on the outcome of today's CIA meeting.
Stryker's face had returned to stoic, but his voice betrayed him. He was enjoying this a tad too much. I turned and stared at him. Bets? Again? I hated that. No pressure, though.
I'm not worried about it. Neither is command.
Stryker and I both worked for Iniqua Security. We do the things that the alphabets would like to do on their own, but red tape and politics shackled them. At Iniquis, we didn't have to deal with those kinds of constraints. Our sole purpose was to get the bad guys into the hands of prosecutors and protect the innocent. Stryker commanded Strike Force, one of the five specialized Iniquis operations groups. I was attached to Strike Force, though I wasn't under Stryker's command. A good thing. I didn't think I'd want to be in an intimate relationship with someone who had power over me. I've been working at Iniquis ever since Strike Force stepped into my life to protect me from a serial killer 4 years ago. Wow, 4 years. Yeah, though I was 19 when that all went down, it still seemed like yesterday. A string of devastating events over a few short months. Mom's death. My mentor, Spider McGraw, went off-grid, leaving me rudderless. My apartment building burned to the ground. I met my soon-to-be ex-husband, Angel. And a whirlwind romance led Angel and me to the courthouse for quick wedding vows. Immediately after Angel and I said I do, Angel stepped onto the bus taking him to the airport and off to Afghanistan, where his Ranger unit was deploying. And that was when a serial killer left his first letter under my door. Stryker strode into my hospital room, scooped me up, and stole away with me to an Iniquis safe house after I survived the killer's attack. There, Strike Force's job was to protect me and keep me alive so I could testify. I figured a few crime puzzles out while I was sequestered in the safe house, and Iniquis Command recognized the skills taught to me by one of their own, Spider McGraw. And that's how I came to be part of the Iniquis family. Spider. Wow, I haven't seen Spider since Christmas. Hadn't heard a word. That he called, commanded, and hung up. Typical Spider. It was a puzzle. To figure it out, I needed more pieces. I was champing at the bit to hear what the FBI wanted to say to me. I moved to my closet and rifled through the hangers. CIA and potentially FBI today. What did I want to wear? I pulled out a pair of gray dress pants and a pale blue short-sleeved summer sweater. With my phone, panties, and bra gathered, I took everything into the bathroom to get ready. and wait for the phone call. Yep, Spider had poked his Anansi trickster head out from his hidey hole. A lifelong family friend of my parents, after Dad's death, Spider took up the role of a second father. I loved Spider for everything he has taught me through the years. My ethos, my code, my stability. If Spider said, jump into the lava lake, I'd jump knowing that he would have weighed everything and trusted that I could successfully swim to the other side. Somewhere, there was lava. And Spider had said jump. Chapter 3. Emerging from the bathroom, I lifted my nose to the scent of coffee wafting up the stairs. Bless you, Stryker. I'd admit it. Last night's road dream was ill-timed. I didn't feel game ready. The shower hadn't done the trick, but the coffee... I hustled down the stairs to the kitchen, where Stryker leaned his hips into the counter. He was wearing his butter-soft, overwashed jeans that were missing their top button, and nothing else. He crossed his ankles comfortably as he cradled a mug. I looked up at the kitchen clock, and then back at the staircase. If only the call would come in from the FBI, I'd know if there was time to jog up the stairs and work off some stress with a little sheet aerobics.
Chica,
Stryker said, as I turned back to cast a longing look down the length of his body.
If you keep licking your lips while you eye me like candy, I'm turning your phone to airplane mode and throwing you over my shoulder to take you back to bed.
Promise? He stalled with a tip of his head, then reached for the mug he'd already doctored for me with milk and sugar.
Lexi, you need to pace yourself. This isn't going to be the easiest of weeks.
I accepted the mug, sliding onto one of the kitchen chairs, repositioning to face Stryker.
It's your mom's birthday. Were you dreaming about her last night?
I lifted my chin, asking with my body language why he guessed that.
Row, row, row your boat.
Ah. I took a sip from the mug. I'm sorry if I kept you awake. Yeah. I've had a flood of memories about my parents over these last few days. It's the most curious thing.
Tell me.
I waggled my hand toward my back. It's like they're both right there, looking over my shoulder. Stryker's brows laced. He was probably afraid of what new woo-woo channel was playing on my psychic network. While Stryker usually dealt with my psychic senses just fine, he still didn't love that I could see and sense and do things in the ether where he had little dexterity beyond the senses typically developed by SEALs in the field. During his military career, Stryker built those capabilities, the sense of eyes on him, reading a room, a hovering foot that just knew there was a tripwire hidden. But that was the extent of it. And for me, that was baby talk.
Your parents are just checking in.
His voice sounded one part hopeful, two parts braced.
I don't remember you mentioning ghosts as part of your experiences.
I waggled my hand again, like an antenna trying to home in on a signal. Ghosts? That doesn't sound right. It's not the term I'd use. Presence? Yeah, I don't know that I've experienced my parents hanging out with me in quite this way since either of them died. I scratched at my chin.
No words, just a sensation.
Exactly. Like they're worried. Like, I looked up at the ceiling. Yeah, I don't know. Just kind of hanging out over my right shoulder. Stryker rubbed the back of his neck.
All right, Chica. But if you pick up a knowing, I get to hear about it straight away.
I gave him a mock salute and picked up my coffee, taking a deep, satisfying inhale before I put the mug to my lips. A knowing was the word I used when a psychic phrase came to me. It used to be that they happened all the time as a child. Simple, silly things like waking up to the nursery rhyme Humpty Dumpty, and I would know that Dad would be making eggs for breakfast. Since Mom died, the childish knowings had stopped. Just like before, information was presented as children's rhymes, baby songs, or even kids' stories. But they were never innocent. Now, they usually presaged life or death horror. It was understandable why Stryker was worried that last night's row, row, row your boat had worked its way into my dreams. I stilled. Shit, was it a knowing? With that thought, my phone buzzed on the table. The vibrations bobbled it against the hard surface, sending it spinning. I snatched it up. Hello?
Lynx, it's Finley.
Steve Finley used my Iniquis call sign. He was an FBI special agent whom I had crossed paths with on many an assignment. His lane was domestic terrorism. That he was the one calling was information. Good morning.
I got a text saying this wasn't too early to call.
Finley's voice sounded tired.
5 is a shitty time to reach out, but this was my window. I hope you understand.
No worries. I was waiting for you while I got a cup of coffee in me.
I've been chugging coffee for the last 24 hours. If I got shot, I'd bleed caffeine.
No evil eye, no evil eye, no evil eye, I chanted with a grin.
Ha, that's right. No need to curse myself into not making it through today.
My smile fell off. Are you in danger?
Me? No. I'm at the office and plan to stay here at least through this evening. So you got the warning call to expect me?
FBI in general. I'm glad it's you in this specific. I like working with people with whom I've already built a rapport. It saves time.
And our time is very compressed. Have you eaten breakfast yet?
Just coffee.
We'd like for you to come to FBI headquarters to be read into the program and talk to our specialist this afternoon. Does that work for you?
I'm headed to Langley at 11. Let me give them a 2-hour window and an hour to get from point A to point B. Would 1,400 hours work?
I believe so. I'd like you to do me a favor, though. I'm going to text you the address of a diner. If it works in today's schedule, we'd like for you to go there for breakfast and put your eyes on a young server named Modesty Turlington.
Modesty? As in shy?
Yes. Well, I don't know about synonyms, but her parents named her Modesty on her birth certificate.
I curled my fingers and looked at the hangnail I'd been worrying. I lifted it to my mouth and nibbled it off, leaving a raw red spot. I knew a couple once that called their son Brave.
And was he?
Finley asked. Hard to tell. I never saw him in a situation where he needed to be particularly courageous. He's 4 years old, though. I guess time will tell.
A name with big shoes to fill.
I could hear the smile in Finley's voice.
Out of curiosity, did he have any siblings?
His sister, Pam.
Those names seem on either end of a naming spectrum.
Their last name was Lamb, so it's Pam Lamb and Brave Lamb. I'm sure they had their reasons.
Surely.
There was a long pause that I filled by taking a sip of coffee.
About Modesty,
Finley continued.
I'd like you to get a feel for her before you get any other information about the situation. So we're hoping you can go by her work and get eyes on.
Okay. If I do that, she's going to see my face, so I should dress for my role.
Here's the deal. Modesty was raised in ongoing difficulties. And like many children who were in survival mode,
she developed...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?